Tell me what's happening. What's the buzz? Tell me what's happening.
Why is John Boehner stepping down as the House Speaker? Well, he's about to tell you on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. News and information. I'm Bill Radke, and welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. We're going to go live to the news conference from John Boehner as soon as he starts that up. We are all hour long going to talk about the top stories of this week, and Bill Finkbeiner is one of our panelists, used to be the Republican State Senate Majority Leader. You know something about being a Republican lawmaker who leaves.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an unusual thing to happen, actually, in politics. It's interesting today.
Yeah. How shocked were you by that announcement that he's out of here?
Oh, I mean, absolutely shocked. You know, I don't have any special insights to D.C., but, you know, just everything, you know, that I've read and heard about it, it really sounded like he still had a pretty strong hold on power. And again, that's unusual for somebody to step down in that position. And it just seems so unbelievably sudden.
From the Mossback, from Crosscut.com, Canute Berger's with us. Hi, Canute.
Hey.
And from Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel, Joni Balter.
Good morning.
Hi, Joni.
Hi.
Did anybody else think, man, he just got done listening to the Pope talk about all the terrible partisanship in the Capitol?
Well, one thing I was thinking was,
you know, Joni, I'm going to have to ask you to hold that thought because John Boehner stepped into the lectern on KUOW.
More accountable government. And over the last 5 years, our majority has advanced conservative reforms that will help our children and their children. We're now on track to cut government spending by $2.1 trillion over the next 10 years. We've made the first real entitlement reform in nearly two decades. And we've protected 99% of the American people from an increase in our taxes. And we've done all this with a Democrat in the White House. So I'm proud of what we've accomplished. But more than anything, my first job as Speaker is to protect the institution. A lot of you know that, my plan was to step down at the end of last year. I decided in November of 2010 that when I was elected Speaker that serving two terms would have been plenty. And but in June of last year, when it became clear that the majority leader lost his election, I frankly didn't believe it was right for me to leave at the end of last year. So my goal was to leave at the end of this year. So I planned actually on my birthday, November 17th, to announce that I was leaving at the end of the year. But it's become clear to me that this prolonged leadership turmoil would do irreparable harm to the institution. So this morning, I informed my colleagues that I would resign from the speakership and resign from Congress at the end of October. Now, as you've often heard me say, this isn't about me. It's about the people. It's about the institution. Just yesterday, we witnessed the awesome sight of Pope Francis addressing the greatest legislative body in the world. And I hope that we will all heed his call to live by the golden rule. But last night I started to think about this, and this morning I woke up and I said my prayers, as I always do, and I decided, you know, today's the day I'm going to do this. As simple as that. That's the code I've always lived by. If you do the right things for the right reasons, the right things will happen. And I know good things lie ahead for this House in this country, and I'm proud of what we've accomplished, especially proud of my team. You know, I've been here my 25th year here, and I've succeeded in large part because I've put a staff together and a team together, many of which have been with me for a long time. And without a great staff, you can't be a great member, and you certainly can't be a great speaker. I'm going to thank my family for putting up with this all these years. My poor girls, who are now 37 and 35, their first campaign photo was in July of 1981. And so they've had to endure all this. It's one thing for me to have to endure it. I've got thick skin. You know, the girls and my wife, they've had to put up with a lot over the years. Let me express my gratitude to my constituents who've sent me here 13 times. Over the last 25 years, you can't get here without getting votes. And I've said this often. People ask me, what's the greatest thing about being speaker or about being an elected official? And I said, well, it's the people you get to meet. You know, I've met tens of thousands of people in my own congressional district that I would never have met other than the fact that I decided to run for Congress. And over the years, as I traveled on behalf of my colleagues in the party, I've met tens of thousands of additional people all over the country. And you meet rich people, you meet poor people, you meet interesting people, and probably a few boring ones along the way. But I can tell you that 99.9% of the people I meet on the road, anywhere, could not be nicer than they've been. It's been wonderful. It's been an honor to serve in this institution. And with that, all right, Junior, go ahead.
Speaker Boehner, you were noticeably overcome with emotion yesterday.
Really? Well, what a surprise.
I'm curious, is if you reached this decision last night, if the grace of Pope Francis led you to this decision?
No. Yesterday was a wonderful day. It really was. And was I emotional yesterday? Yeah, I think I was. I was really emotional in a moment that really no one saw. As the Pope and I were getting ready to exit the building, we found ourselves alone. And the Pope grabbed my left arm and said some very kind words to me about my commitment to kids and education. And the Pope puts his arm around me and kind of pulls me to him and says, please pray for me. Well, who am I to pray for the Pope? But I did.
If it wasn't the Pope, then what was it?
It was never about the vote, all right? There was never any doubt about whether I could survive a vote. I don't want my members to have to go through this. I certainly don't want the institution to go through this. And so, especially when, you know, I knew I was thinking about walking out the door anyway. So it's the right time to do it, and frankly, I am entirely comfortable doing it.
We've been listening to John Boehner. You get the idea. He wants to protect the institution. He says that's his main job. He says the turmoil in the House may do irreparable harm to that institution. And you just heard him say it didn't hurt that Pope Francis grabbed him by the left arm and said, pray for me. And so he has decided, a surprise to all, although he says he'd been thinking about it, he's decided to not only step down as Speaker, but to leave Congress at the end of October. You're listening to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with, as I've introduced, Bill Finkbeiner and Knute Berger and Joni Balter. We had just before he started to speak talk about, gee, you think the Pope interaction had anything to do with it?
Well, I was wondering, partly in jest, if the Pope said, look, here's how this works. Here's what you should do. But, you know, Boehner's a very emotional guy. He's very worried about what will happen with another government shutdown. This could very well be just a full-on principled stand about maybe getting through the steps to not have a shutdown and then not have to worry about being the Speaker. To get that out of the way, to take the time, get the budget going. He's going to have to work with some Democrats to make that happen. But really, just to sort of save the honor of Congress.
Can you tell Bill Finkbeiner, former Republican majority leader in the Senate, what this means for Planned Parenthood and the government shutdown?
You know, it's going to be interesting to see who rises up as the next speaker and the front runners for the next speaker. It sounds
Do we think institutional guy, Tea Party guy? Can we tell anything yet?
You know, what it sounds like is you know, Boehner's been a very controversial figure, but I think it's unlikely that we'll see somebody as moderate as him replace him. And that, you know, that'll be really interesting. As far as the shutdown, it sounds like this, you know, may help avoid that. And that, you know, it both gives him more freedom to maneuver and also I think buys him some goodwill and sort of a reprieve from, you know, some of the controversy that's been in that caucus.
Knute Berger, any more reaction before we move to Seattle area news?
Well, it's interesting because certainly in the era that I grew up in, the Speaker of the House was sort of a permanent position for a lot of guys. I mean, you expected them to serve for a long time. They were also very strong leaders who got things done. I'm thinking Sam Rayburn and people like that. But it's become a little bit more of a turnstile. I mean, we've had speakers like Tom Foley, defeated
of Washington.
First time that had ever happened, a speaker being defeated for re-election. We've had any number of speakers in recent years have problems with scandal. You know, I mean, for all his influence of the Pope and the Golden Rule and all that, I think the basic issue comes down to the fact that John Boehner was not a strong leader given the dynamics that were growing on the Republican side in the House. He was having trouble holding his people together, getting them to line up behind him. There was essentially a opposition. And, you know, he's giving into that. And it's kind of a strategic retreat, I think, as Bill mentioned, that may please his enemies and his friends in the short term. But I think it is a failure of leadership.
We'll see who replaces John Boehner as the Republican House Speaker. He's out of there at the end of October. Well, it's a sad morning in Seattle. I imagine you know by now that a Ride the Ducks tourist bus, one of those well-known amphibious vehicles that carry tourists around our city, it was on the Aurora Bridge in Seattle when it collided with a tour bus carrying students, international students from North Seattle College, and four of those students have died. We know that they're from Austria, China, Indonesia, and Japan. And we know that two more people are in critical condition, about a dozen others hospitalized as of this morning. And today, the National Transportation Safety Board starts trying to find out what happened on that bridge. The Seattle Times recorded an interview in the hospital with one of the tourists who was a passenger on that Ride the Ducks bus. His name is Tim Gessner, and here he is.
We were coming across the Aurora Bridge, and the driver indicated that off to the right side now is the best time. If you wanted to take a picture of the lake, you could get a great shot of it. So I was sitting in the very last seat in the back, so I stood up and turned right, holding my cell phone to take the picture. And just as I was taking the picture, all of a sudden I felt the back of the ducks start to fishtail, and just at that moment, as it was starting to fishtail, I heard the driver go, "Oh no!" And I turned to look forward because I was standing up, so I had a clear view over the top of everybody. I just saw the duck just heading left, right into two pickup trucks in the side of a tour bus, and you could just see it. It was like you saw the impact, and then the next thing was, it's like you see in the movies. I was just floating in this surreal world of it was like I was in slow motion, bouncing off of things and just feeling the pain shooting everywhere, and then my face slamming against the seat in front of me, and then it was quiet. And I just turned and looked, and that's when I saw the carnage, not only around me, but as I stood up and I looked off to my right, because I was looking at the back of to get to my wife, because I got thrown two seats forward as I was standing up. As I stood up to move across the seats, I could see the two pickup trucks that had, when we hit them, they collided and they were pretty devastated. And then I turned to look to the front and I saw the bus that we had hit as well. And it was just, I knew it was really bad. So first and foremost, I just wanted to get to my wife to make sure she was okay. And then I believe I told you that's when I realized she was okay, and I stood up and looked forward, and I saw that beautiful girl that was with her mom looking over the edge of the dock and crying. And I looked, and I moved over and looked out the side, and there was her mom laying in a puddle of blood on the road. And that's when I finally was able to get out and start helping. I put one of the life preservers under her head to try to help her because she was in pretty bad shape.
That was, wow. That was Tim Gessner from Orlando, Florida. He was one of the he and his wife were riding on this Ride the Ducks tourist bus yesterday when it collided. And from everything I've heard, it sounds like it just, you know, they're still investigating, but that it careened into this charter bus on the Aurora Bridge and killed four people, and somebody else is in critical condition. So with me this hour to talk about this, Seattle Channel's Joni Balter. Joni, we're waiting for more information, but I know when I heard about this yesterday, I wondered, how safe are those Ride the Ducks buses, and how safe is that bridge?
Definitely a good question about the bridge in particular. I heard KUOW asking people to answer that question. How safe do you feel when you're driving across the Aurora Bridge? I can just speak for myself. I have always wondered why people were going so fast, where the heck a relatively narrow car that I drive was actually going to fit. I noticed that I always sort of go into the middle lane so that I'm not like right up against the edge or up against that little flimsy yellow line that separates. And we know from a 2003 or 2002 report that there were recommendations made to make this bridge safer, but then nothing happened. In other words, what was recommended were wider lanes. Those lanes are super, they're the narrowest in the state, apparently, for a bridge, or the bridge is the narrowest in the state.
And that would mean they're not talking about widening the bridge itself, because that would be too heavy, but maybe just going down maybe four lanes instead of six and don't make them so narrow.
Right, right? And also a median, which would
have... Yeah, a barrier in between.
Presumably, you can't say for sure, but presumably would have made things a little better if there were a median to stop this duck that was moving and swerving to the left into the oncoming traffic. So, yeah, I think we have a lot of questions about the safety of this roadway that we rely on so heavily. Many, many people ride it all day, you know, every day.
Yeah. On our Facebook page, Anita said, the lanes are really narrow. The Metro buses seem to be too wide to fit in a lane, and I grit my teeth and hope for the best every time I drive across it. And that's exactly my feeling when I go across the Aurora Bridge. Like, it's a white knuckle, hope this goes okay feeling. Knute Berger's with us, too, this hour.
Well, every time I go over it, it seems gridlocked. So it's
right.
The opposite problem.
Right.
But obviously, this is one of those really tear-jerky kind of stories, partly because the ducks kind of represent fun.
Yeah.
The kids on that bus are coming from overseas to a new school. They were on a tour of the city. You know, it's all happy, good times that sort of come to a screeching halt. It's easy to jump to the conclusion that the bridge needs fixing or some type of thing, but until you really know what caused the accident.
Right.
But it is interesting that the state has looked into it, has made recommendations, and that those recommendations haven't been implemented. And I think everybody agrees that, particularly given the volume and speed of traffic, given when that bridge was built, that a lot of our bridges, a lot of our streets aren't really prepared for the levels of traffic that we have on them. And so it seems like a wise course to revisit those recommendations.
We heard that that tourist who's in the hospital now describing what happened, and he said that, if I heard him right, that the driver said, okay, good time to get your pictures. And he stands up in the bus. And I'm not even aware. I don't know this for sure, but I don't think that there are even seat belt, or at least there's not a requirement that everybody's belted in on that bus as a routine, not just this driver, right? Is that your understanding?
Right, yeah. I mean, I've been on the duck once with my granddaughter, and I mean, everybody's bouncing around and singing and waving their arms, taking
quacking,
pictures, quacking.
And,
you can stand up. I mean,
party
people
bus.
Are not required to wear seat belts in what's essentially a bus. So,
right,
and many of them don't even have.
Well,
the option.
One of the interesting quotes that I read came from a former Ducks driver who they all knew about this bridge, mm-hmm. because this person said that is the scariest part of sort of the duck scenic tour, is that when you're going across the bridge, because the lanes are so narrow and people are going too quickly. And so that's a formula for trouble, really.
Bill Finkbeiner with us as well. Bill, any reaction?
I don't know. It's just so tragic. And I guess the only thing I was thinking is, you know, sometimes it seems like the studies are, You know, it's all numerical and statistical, and, you know, sometimes it feels like, boy, they could just ask people, what are those white knuckle portions of, you know, your drive through town? And it'd probably get pretty standard responses, and, you know, that people know. And but I don't know, you know, that audio from that guy in the hospital is tough.
Yeah. Well, your heart just goes out to all those people, including the people who were in the two other cars. I mean, all of them.
Yep. And we're being asked to help the families of these overseas, these international students. You know, families, God, you know, they're coming here, you know, trying to figure out what happened, as we all are. The National Transportation Safety Board starts its investigation today. So we'll tell you what they learn when we know on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. A quick break and then more of the Week in Review. Covering the top stories of the week, this is KUOW's Week in Review, and of course, the Chinese President Xi Jinping stopped here to meet with our big businesses, and KUOW reporter Carolyn Adolph covered that trip. Carolyn, there were so many issues at play in this visit. What actually happened this week that was important?
That's a really good question. You look back on it now, and what we got out of the visit was a T-shirt and 300 planes. But it was sort of a cobbled together thing. It was as if China was saying, we're big, we can put together all these orders to make 300 planes. But we're also human. We too love Hemingway. And it was,
I missed the Hemingway part. What happened around Hemingway?
Oh, this was an NPR report from his apparently super important policy speech that he gave in Seattle on Tuesday. Was it Tuesday night? Hmm. Anyway, all she decided that she was worth reporting in the end was the fact that he spoke of his love of Hemingway's novel, The Old Man and the Sea, and that when he was a more junior bureaucrat, he had gone to Cuba and had hung out at Hemingway's old bar and had lifted the famous Hemingway drink there. Lord knows what it is. I don't remember. Something with mint. Anyway.
Probably rum.
So that's it. It's rum and mint. So he was basically saying, look, I too, you know, I too like the same things as you like. So that was the cultural moment.
And 300 planes.
300 planes.
Was that actually something that came out of the visit, or we assume this was just a, you know, this was a nicely timed announcement?
It's a nicely timed announcement that bits and pieces of it were leaked out in the week prior to his arrival.
Yeah.
And when his plane touched down and he and his wife got out of the plane, they were being loaded into their silver SUV to be whisked away, a foreign ministry spokesman came out to address media and basically presaged that this would happen, because he talked about that there would be definitely matters of material substance that would occur, and that would be 300 planes and a factory.
So a plane order that would have happened anyway, and wasn't there also an announcement that for the first time Boeing is going to have a production facility out of the States and in China?
Yes, an after production facility. So it's actually, you know, the saddest moment of the 737 line is when they load the seats in, because you're like, oh no, now it's going to get all crowded and uncomfortable with all the seats.
And they were more crowded.
It looked so roomy a moment ago.
That's right. But so that sad moment is now going to occur in China. But it's what's interesting about this is that right now about a third of the planes that roll off the 737 line end up there. And that's a lot of back-end work that is now going to be happening somewhere else.
How do the unions feel about that?
Well, they're concerned that this is going to result in job leakage to another place. And what they're saying is either, you know, we would have gained work or this looks like losing work. And Boeing has said this isn't losing work. There are no jobs to be lost. But, you know, there's no time limit on that. They didn't say forever there will be no jobs lost.
Yeah, I don't get if they're painting them there and not here, how the machinist union here is not losing jobs.
Mm.
Hmm. Okay.
That's what an analyst has said as well, is that logic doesn't wash.
Okay. And finally, Carolyn, the backdrop of that in Washington State is that we paid Boeing so much in the form of tax breaks to keep the jobs here, right?
Yes, indeed. Well, we bargained for a production line, which we obtained, but somehow jobs are still leaking out around the edges. And there's a great deal of frustration because that happened in a major way with the 787 years ago. And it was promised that this kind of leakage would not occur. And we just don't seem to be able to write an agreement that will guarantee that outcome.
So what you have is you have a specific agreement on the 777X, but you have this sort of promise that Renton is increasing the number of planes that it's going to pump out per month until now, until for the next few years. But what you don't have is a promise that jobs won't leak. And so those are jobs they're saying, well, those are future jobs. Those are jobs that don't subtract from the total.
Right.
But I don't know how you do that math.
Yeah, that's it. That's what they're playing at. But yes, the $8.7 billion was to secure the 777 line.
Bill Finkbeiner, you've been out of the legislature too long to have given up those tax breaks, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was there for the first set, but not the second set.
So what do you think? Is this an outrage?
I look at it a little bit more rosily, I guess. I think that, a couple of things. 300 orders, that's a lot of airplanes. And, you know, the bottom line is Boeing has been increasing production. And they hopefully did learn the lesson from the 787, and at least for the key parts of the plane, the tail section, the wings, the components that actually make the thing fly, that seems to have been a bit more consolidated. So I think that this was a big deal having, the president of China here and making these announcements, even if it's largely symbolic. He still did it here. He didn't do it in Chicago, which is the headquarters of Boeing. He didn't do it in L.A. or San Francisco or New York. He did it in Seattle.
Right. He could have gone to Silicon Valley or lots of other places.
Yeah, that was a big deal, I think.
Let me press you, though. Were those tax breaks a mistake?
It's really difficult dealing with Boeing at this point in time. Once they moved to Chicago, you're really negotiating against somebody who really doesn't care about the region, and it's just bottom line. So I don't think so. I think at the end of the day, there'd be a lot less work in Washington State had they not done those. And I think, the ultimate net result is going to be more tax revenue, and especially when you look at all the suppliers and ancillary services that Boeing drives, it's still, they're still significantly here. But, you're not dealing with somebody who cares about the future of Washington State when you're dealing with Boeing. They're very bottom line driven at this point.
Knut Berger, what was your big impression of the Chinese president's visit?
It was interesting to contrast it with the Pope's visit. And obviously you have a religious leader versus a secular politician. But it struck me that Xi's visit was it was kind of like it was a very chamber of commerce, very, very much oriented toward, people getting together to make money. And of course, I mean, the Northwest's, our whole kind of raison d'etre for European settling this area was the China trade. It's been, since the otter trade of 18th century, that's been one of the driving factors. And I think it's increasing, which is interesting. I mean, you see Vancouver, San Francisco, to some degree Bellevue and Seattle, there's more Chinese investment money coming here as the stock market is getting rocky in China. There's more interest in putting money in more places in the United States, real estate particularly. So, the ties are growing. With China and with Boeing, there's always this issue of kind of moral ambivalence, moral concern, both in terms of China, it's with human rights issues, also shipping jobs overseas. And, so it's interesting because everything is portrayed in this very positive prosperity kind of thing. But there's also this constant undercurrent of, are we sort of selling part of our souls to doing business with these folks or to be giving these tax breaks to Boeing when, they don't love us back?
Mm. On the plus side, it was a good week for climate change because you had both the Pope and Xi Jinping talking about really doing something about climate change. The Pope had the better product placement with the Fiat Cinquecento, which is sort of like a fancy lawnmower. But and then the Chinese president, a little different vehicle. But
Carolyn Adolph, finally, was it really just a Chamber of Commerce visit? Did we hear enough about human rights protests while he was here?
No, absolutely not. We didn't hear enough about that. It was very much a lovely window dressing event with, as you say, you know, a small amount of hijinks and good high spirits. But I think that those masked the darker issues that really need to be explored.
Carolyn Adolph, who was with the Chinese president all week long, as the Chinese government conducted a military exercise to find out whether it could paralyze a major American city merely by moving motorcades around its main population centers. Carolyn, thank you for getting around and for coming back. Back with the Week in Review in a moment. KUOW's Week in Review. Is this the beginning of the end for Tim Iman? Haven't we asked that before?
We always ask that.
Him and Donald Trump. It's never the end.
Yeah.
It's funny you would say that. His response was very Trumpian.
To remind you, dear listener, Tim Iman is famous for spearheading popular Washington state initiatives that make it harder for the government to raise taxes. He makes his living doing that, even though sometimes his popular initiatives are struck down. Well, this week, state investigators accused Iman of receiving secret payments from a paid signature-gathering company and illegally using campaign money for personal expenses. KUOW's Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins. Hi, Austin.
Hi, Bill. Do you remember when Tim Iman was referred to as a watch salesman?
A watch salesman. Yes, I do.
Leo, yeah.
Yes.
That finally faded out.
I will ask you if this is the end of Tim Iman, but first, explain just a little more what he allegedly did, if you would.
Well, this goes back to 2012, and there were a couple of measures on the ballot. One had to do with that his favorite topic, two-thirds for tax hikes. The other had to do with protecting, he would say, some would say giving signature gatherers a lot more access to the public and to stores, businesses. Basically, the allegation was that he was using two-thirds tax hike money for that other initiative. At the end of the day, the real issue here, though, is it appears, if these allegations are true, that he was getting a kickback from Citizen Solutions, which was his signature gathering firm. And back then, it was a $300,000 check that he received, and about $170,000 of that he allegedly spent on personal expenses. And that's what seems to be the issue. And furthermore, the guy who used to run Citizen Solutions says that over the years there were several payments like this back to Tim Iman, sort of thank you for sending us business or consultant payments that were not apparently reported.
How does Tim Iman respond?
Well, he's not. His attorney is responding and saying that the report omits and mischaracterizes evidence, saying that the allegations are brought by a disgruntled former vendor and that he will be ultimately cleared and exonerated. What Tim Iman is doing, we are hearing from him. In fact, during the PDC meeting yesterday, Tim Iman sent out an email asking for more money for 1366 and for his ongoing efforts. He's also been very busy with the Secretary of State's office. I counted 14 new initiatives to the legislature that he's filed just this month. So he's active. He's out there, but he's not at this point talking about these allegations.
14 new initiatives, and he's saying, look how I'm driving the establishment crazy. Here's the form you can fill out and donate more money to the cause. So is this, I asked, is this the beginning of the end of Tim Iman, or isn't it?
Well, this seems to sort of conjure that notion of rumors of my demise have been greatly exaggerated. Mm-hmm. You know, as you said, people have been predicting, maybe those who don't like Tim Iman have been hoping for his demise. If this passion play plays out like it did in 2002, because remember, he was hit with a $50,000 fine back in 2002 for something kind of similar, basically unreported salary. He was prohibited, lifetime prohibition on being a treasurer of a campaign committee. And then he did this very contrite interview with David Ammons of the Associated Press at that time, basically saying this was the biggest lie of my life. So maybe the way this plays out is that the attorney general takes action. Perhaps there's a penalty if these allegations are found to be true. And perhaps Tim Iman gives a contrite interview and says, I did wrong. The other possibility, though, is could it be two strikes, you're out? If the AG finds that he did this and did it again, they may come down on him really hard this time, because 2002 wasn't that long ago, and these are very similar allegations.
Come down hard meaning jail, or meaning can they can't make him stop filing initiatives?
You're right. But there's two things that could take him out. One is, you know, the way he operates is he needs people to give him money. And typically that's the sugar daddy variety, some deep-pocketed interest who believes in the particular initiative and gives him money. It can be an individual, wealthy individuals. It can be the business community. We've seen that in the past where they get behind something he's doing. They may not love Tim Iman, but they get in bed with him because they like what he's trying to do on the ballot that year. But the other piece of this is that what was said in the PDC this week is that this is being referred to the Attorney General for civil and possible criminal review. I think it's a long shot that this would get to the criminal state, but if that happened, that could certainly have ramifications and implications for his future that potentially could take him out of contention. But as I said, I think it's early. I think this will take a long time to kind of get to the end point. And we've seen that Tim Iman seems to be, you know, have nine lives plus. He comes back, he comes back, he comes back. And he's got a lot of voters out there who may or may not like him personally, but seem to like the issues he's bringing to the fore.
That's right. Let's talk about that. KOW's Olympia correspondent, Austin Jenkins, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Bill.
So we have a Republican, former Republican lawmaker, Bill Finkbeiner. And Austin's last point, it goes to the bigger picture. If his anti-tax initiatives are so popular, why don't state lawmakers pass them? Why do we need Tim Iman?
Well, obviously, state lawmakers don't always agree with what Iman's proposals are, which is why he's been so controversial. He's perfected both the art and the science of the initiative process, the art of picking topics that are popular, whether they're constitutional or not, and that he can raise money for. And then the science of actually getting the signatures and running the organization. But this is a big deal. It is not very often that the PDC sends these cases to the Attorney General. So this is a big step forward. But what I would say is I think it's a big deal for Tim Iman personally. I think, you know, everything bad that can possibly be said about Tim Iman's pretty much been said already. Mm-hmm. And I think at this point in time, the people that are voting for the initiatives and a lot of the people that are giving money to the initiatives are not doing it because of Tim Iman. So I don't see this stopping his organization, but it could be a serious thing for him personally.
Joni?
So fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. So I'm thinking now of the people who give money to him. Mm-hmm. And let's look at the long term here. Tim Iman has been on the scene for, what, like 15 years? He himself personally has never been before the voters, just these popular issues. So he has really sort of established himself in some ways as a fourth branch of government without ever personally going to the voters himself.
Accomplished that much?
Well,
$30 car tab.
Yes. The two-thirds debate that rages on endlessly. He's had a lot of impact. And, you know, the whole thing here is about transparency and the lack of it. You know, he could have been paid this amount of money if he just wrote it down. Just tell people. There's no harm in making money off of initiatives if you're honest about it. But this has happened before. He had the Terry press interview at the time, and now he's in deep trouble.
Knut Berger?
Well, you know, there's sort of two different things that are closely associated. One is Tim Iman, and one is the initiative process. And there is frustration on the part of a lot of legislators in Olympia, actually of both parties, over what initiatives have become. And in some ways, it's an institutional discomfort because legislators don't like to be told what to do. But Iman over the years, I mean, he can turn himself quickly into a martyr, which helps generate more funds. But the real issue is, should the initiative process be a for-profit business really for everybody? The money that flows in to initiative campaigns, the money that obviously is flowing to Tim Iman and how he's accounting for that money and spending that money. I mean, I think that is a real issue. And Iman advocates for the initiative process. And sometimes he's right, I think, about pushing back on some of the legislative proposals to restrict it. But I think having turned it into something well more than a cottage industry is potentially really, really destructive over time. And I've sort of joked, I mean, that that it seems to me sometimes like these initiatives become kind of campaign money machines where that flow to particularly to TV stations and whatnot.
Oh, mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, well, if the state needs some more money, we'll just pit the insurance companies against the trial lawyers, or just pick the biggest, fattest target and do an initiative on that campaign, and we'll get hundreds of millions of dollars rolling into the state. The process was one of election reform and democracy that was never intended to be this kind of, huge special interest beasts battling it out, or people making an affluent living off of running permanent campaigns.
Well, I think it's working exactly the way the framers intended it, actually. I think that, there's people making a living running permanent campaigns all over in politics. And a couple of things about the initiative process that I think people forget is one, there's a reason it was put there. So first of all, Tim Iman can't pass an initiative. His funders can't pass an initiative. At the end of the day, it goes to the people. There's a reason that was put in the Constitution, is to have, reserve that right for the people to have a way around the legislature. And, the legislature does the same, plays the same sort of hijinks and raises money in very similar ways. So I actually think, it's, in a lot of ways, it's working the way it's supposed to. The other thing that people forget about is that Tim Iman, can't pass an initiative and it's permanently in law forever. After 2 years, the legislature can overturn any one of his initiatives with a 50% vote. So I think that the hiding the money is deplorable. And I think, it really is important that this be sent to the AG's office. But I think, to go too broadly to like the whole initiative process, so we got to be a little careful there.
Okay, we're running out of time to continue recapping the week's news. The bottom line there is that the State Public Disclosure Commission has forwarded this on to the Attorney General. Maybe civil, maybe criminal charges. We'll see. We'll follow it on KUOW's Week in Review. The Week in Review continues. This week, a Miami-based developer said it's planning a new Seattle skyscraper, 101 stories. That's 25 stories taller than the Columbia Center, which this new building would be right next to. What does this mean for the Columbia Center and your city? I talked to Puget Sound Business Journal's Emily Parkhurst about this, and first of all, she told me this new building would be just to the west of the Columbia Center, so that tower would lose at least a big chunk of its view.
Well, it's a pretty spectacular view if you've been to the observatory up there.
I've taken my daughter up there, yeah.
Yeah, it's really, I think, the best view in the city. You can look out over Elliott Bay and over to the Olympics on a nice clear day and see the ferries coming in. It's really kind of a cool, very Seattle view.
So how do the owners, by the way, the new owners of the Columbia Center, because it just got sold, how do the new owners feel about this tower going up right to its west?
Well, they haven't really said anything yet. The Columbia Center sold for $711 million earlier this year to a Hong Kong real estate investment firm, and they're not really speaking out right now, and that's not surprising because it is really early stages for this tower. It's still in the design stages, and things could still change.
But what could a view-blocking skyscraper do to the value of the Columbia Center, that new purchase?
It would absolutely have an impact on the value. It's hard to say exactly what that impact would be because we don't know how much an impact it would have on the view, but it would absolutely have an impact on the value of the building.
So is this just the way it is? You build a skyscraper downtown and you never have a guarantee of keeping your view and they just build that in?
That's true for everybody, right? If you have a really nice view from your apartment and they decide to build an apartment building in front of you, there's really nothing you can do about it. And the same is true in downtown Seattle with skyscrapers. The big question here will be whether the FAA allows this building to go up, because it is significantly taller than Columbia Center, and the FAA is reviewing whether it's too tall. It could affect the flight path to Boeing Field.
Why hasn't there been a taller building than the Columbia Center in all these decades?
Well, the original developer of Columbia Center said that he wanted to build the tower taller than 76 stories, but the FAA told him he couldn't because it would impact air traffic in and out of SeaTac. And now that Boeing Field is in use, it's even more of an impact to have a really tall building in downtown Seattle. Even when you're downtown and you're just walking around, you can see the planes flying above the city, and they're relatively low. So there's definitely some concern there about whether this is going to be allowed.
Puget Sound Business Journal digital managing editor Emily Parkhurst was telling me that there are more skyscrapers on the way. You know, we're still booming, not skyscrapers this big, but guess what? We're still going to sprout downtown. Now, by the way, these developers say that they have designed this in a way that will minimize the view impact of surrounding properties. So it may be invisible, because I don't know how else you minimize the impact of 101. It's a see-through building.
Transparent aluminum.
Transparent.
Yes.
How did you react to this, Knut?
Well, my reaction is go ahead and let them build it. But if I were king, I would tell them they could build it, but they can't put elevators in it. And that would guarantee that all the top floors would be affordable housing.
There's your affordable housing.
Yeah, here's. Yeah. Okay. Want affordable housing, you got it.
The price is right.
And, yeah, the views are great.
Just can't get
it. Yeah, I just going back a little bit, remember when the Seafirst building, which is that big black box on 4th Avenue, mm-hmm. Was built. And so the only two tall structures on the skyline were this big black box and the Space Needle. And everybody joked that the tower was the box the Space Needle mm-hmm. came in. So
yep.
Apparently this is going to be the box that the Columbia Tower came in.
Don't forget the Smith Tower, which for many years was the tallest building on the West Coast as well.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting to me about some of this seems like a statement building in some ways, you know, tallest on the West Coast, is so much out of town or even out of country investment in Seattle. Seattle is where the bucks are being made. It's very interesting. In terms of view blocking, I was a little worried about the best bathroom in Seattle, which is the ladies' room at the top of the Columbia Center. Songs have been written, and I certainly hope that view is not blocked, but I can't tell yet if it is.
Fink Minor?
Well, you know, it is interesting that last time it was local boy Martin Seelig,
right.
You know, building the Columbia Center, yeah, and then now these are investors from Florida. But one thing that strikes me is that right when everybody says, boy, we got a ton of growth coming and we've got these big crazy projects that are just breaking ground, that a lot of times is sort of the harebringer for the, you know, the end of the cycle. When people build these really spectacular trophy buildings, there's a lot of times right up at the tippy top. So it makes some of us a little nervous.
Is that a forecast of what comes next?
Everything seems to be going so well as far as real estate in Seattle, but it's right at those times where, sometimes you got news around the corner, but who knows?
Well, I just wanted to say to Joni, the problem isn't that they would block the view of the woman's bathroom. The problem is somebody's looking back at you. You need curtains. That goes up.
You're droning me here, Skip.
KUOW's Week in Review. Hey, we're just about at the end of the hour, and we can't ignore the fact that the Seattle Seahawks haven't won a game in 8 months. They blew another late game lead over the weekend. They're 0-2. They start their home season this weekend. So how gloomy should you be? Mike Pesca, host of Slate's The Gist podcast, knows sports, and we love him. Hey, Mike.
Hey.
How gloomy should we be about the winless Seahawks?
I got some good news for you. Hmm. Camp Chancellor's back.
Yeah.
Oh, God. They should have just paid the guy his few hundred thousand dollars. But you ready for the really big news?
Huh.
They're playing the Bears. They're going to win.
At home, no less.
Bears without their quarterback.
That's right. I could argue they'd be worse with Cutler, but they're 16-point favorites. So they're going to win. You know, it is true, though. You start the season 0-2. I mean, it depends where you pick your point. But since the current divisional structure in 2002, about 10% of the teams that start 0-2 make the playoffs. But I think the Seahawks are going to be one of them. The Colts this year are 0-2 also. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about a couple of teams that made, well, the Seahawks went all the way to the Super Bowl. The Colts made the final. So they're two really good teams.
Okay. Hey, can I ask you, because I've heard you talk about, you know, kids and trophies and sort of the bigger sports picture. We have a local school district here, Mercer Island, who is going to their policy for recess is hands to yourself. which means that they're not going to let kids play tag anymore. At least I think they're going to put some flags in their pockets or something, but no more tag the way tag has been done. Any opinion?
Well, I have named my fantasy football team Participation Trophy Culture because I believe in Participation Trophy Culture. That is not a joke. I have two fantasy football teams. The other one is a Donald Trump reference I probably can't make on the air.
Please.
I think this, you know, dodgeball's been banned. I think that's far worse. Yeah, kids can sometimes touch a little too hard. But if I know kids, this means that they're going to debut headbutt tag on Mercer Island pretty soon.
Mike Pesca of the Gist podcast from Slate, and we'll see. We'll hold him to his prediction that he says the Seahawks are going to win by 60 points. That's what you said, right?
16.
Oh, I heard 60. So
I hear the Bears are playing two-hand tag is the problem.
Mike Pesca, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
KOW's Week in Review, a man is wearing a Seahawks jersey just to my right, Knute Berger.
Yes, I've got the Blue Friday swag on. This is my customized, says Mossback on the back.
It does say Mossback, but if they lose, you're burning that, right?
No.
Okay.
Oh, no.
Knute Berger at Crosscut.com and Seattle Magazine. Joni Balter, host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. Bill Finkbeiner, former Republican State Senate Majority Leader. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Bill.
Our producer is Jason Pagano. Our social media producer, Bon Huberman. Bernard Ouellette engineers the program. Stay tuned. KUOW Seattle. We'll see you next week. Actually, I have an update. This just in. Mercer Island schools have reversed their position on tag. The school superintendent sent an email today saying the district's well-intended hands-off policy has led to confusion, false reporting, and is clearly not supported by many staff and many parents. He goes on to say, tag as we know it and have known it is reinstated. In addition, students may continue to play flag tag as they wish. Other respectful games that involve appropriate physical interaction are also encouraged. That from the Mercer Island School Superintendent. This is KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information.